Well, we had two submarines out there at one time. And
there were submarines off of Barrow?
Oh, yeah, lots.
We had them at the ice station. Okay. Two of them came up one time. That was one time that the classification
we had
busted.
We had a bug that got in the air on the radio and called up the submarines.
A fellow who had been a Pole captured by the Russians at the end of the war. Bernie, what's his last name? Yeah, something that way. He's still alive.
We still get Christmas cards from
him. And, but anyway, Bernie was cook, and of course the radio was in the cook shack, so it would be handy in case a message came through. And here, right next to the aisle, up comes a submarine.
So Bernie grabs the radio and starts talking about the submarines coming.
And quick like a bunny, he got shut off.
Bernie, that's not right.
Yeah, Bernie is right.
Bernie's right, but not my...
But anyway, he'd been a chef.
John shipped him on us,
yeah.
By the way. Your brother.
Yeah,
you should hire him.
A chef at one of the major Chicago hotels. He could take sea rations and make desserts out of them. And, but he was fine. But no, we had numerous classified projects. But
we didn't sell them that way. We didn't acknowledge that they were classified.
And
so K-Cuter was the Navy's code name?
No, Air Force.
No, that was the Air Force.
Oh, Air Force.
And actually, that was not our project. K-Cuter belonged to the Dumine site. Mm-hmm. They supported K-Cuter because that was an Air Force Dumine site.
Yeah, but the thing there is that it's just like for the project for the feasibility of the Dumine.
Mm-hmm.
Was operated out of the laboratory.
And that was probably classified.
It was classified up the gazoo.
Project Lincoln.
And Project Lincoln.
Huh.
And, so, but
they had towers down at Skull Cliff, wasn't that part
no,
of Lincoln?
No, they stole, or they used the tower at Skull Cliff, which was up earlier. But the thing is that if you just went along fat, dumb, and happy, you excited no curiosity. However, there were people that understood things. Because we had a Navy lieutenant when we were searching for one of the ice stations, you know, to, a place to establish.
Mm-hmm.
And
that
we
sucker made captain, I'll never understand that.
Yeah, and the thing was that he was in the co-pilot seat, and I was ice observing, and he intercepted a Russian message.
He spoke Russian, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. And the Russians said that the laboratory was out looking for an ice station, and Brewer was on the plane.
That's what the Russians said?
Oh, yes. They knew every move we made. Every move.
And
they even knew my name, and I was a nothing in those days.
You weren't assistant yet?
Oh, maybe I was. But, you know,
oh, yeah.
That's important.
You're overshadowed by this one by 1,000 degrees. You know, but they knew everything. It was unbelievable.
So, that was the only time that there was ever any classification that was broken. But we had two subs. There's another story. And this was told at the science conference by the chief of the underwater sound lab in Los Angeles in those days. And when the Nautilus was trying to go under the ice, this was the first trip, and bad ice, you know, real close in, and of course submarine. You know, they got to have a little something between them and the ice in the bottom.
Submarines draw a lot more water than people realize.
Yeah.
Subs especially.
And
you know, they draw about 100 and some feet.
And so they couldn't get under, so he went to Barrow. I mean, that was classified out of this world, and only 100 people in the States knew it. So, but he told the story. He said he went to Barrow, and it was in the old lab we were at the time. He said when he went to Barrow, that he was under one restriction, that whatever happened, Brewer must not see him. Because just seeing him would break classification.
It would be a breach of security, because he'd know why he was there.
Because he wasn't supposed to be there?
Yeah.
But, well,
no reason to be there unless there were subs off the barrel.
Yeah. And so he said that he went in the old lab, and the office was in the second story.
Uh-huh.
And so he said here he was going through from the old shop area, and he saw me at the head of the stairs starting to come down, and he dodged for the first door, and it was the ladies' john.
It happened to be the ladies' john.
It was kind of that.
And so he said he spent 10 minutes there, and that fortunately, he's telling this at a conference, science conference. He says, fortunately, none of the ladies had the urge, and he snuck out and took off. Waldo Line. And because in those days, I knew the players. And I knew what their games were. And, of course, the Navy knew what my knowledge of the scheme was. And just by seeing him up there, I wouldn't have to ask him any questions.
Now, Waldo Lyons put a freezing system on a swimming pool and did tests to see what it would take for a conning tower to break the ice.
Or
a conning tower on a submarine to break ice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's obvious this was his major contribution to naval research.
And, of course, he was deeply involved in it.
Yeah.
And so it.
So if Waldo shows up at Barrow, it's rather obvious what must be going on.
Oh, and I told her the story about you and Dick and Ed Donnelly being unhappy that you got downgraded when you went to Iceland. Yeah, you know, I mean, he was a poor commander, but he went to Iceland, for 6 weeks he stole the NATO commander's staff car.
It's terrible. He was an Air Force captain.
Yeah, colonel. Full. He was full bull.
All I can remember is driving by him in the rain, and I'd wave to him in his car. I'm in his car. He's walking in the rain.
And,
oh, I felt bad.
And on the license plate that John was driving, he had eagles. And, of course, as a commander, he didn't deserve eagles.
Yeah. No, that's a camel.
And
but one of the nice things about going to Iceland is that has nothing to do with really all this history business and everything. Surtsey, I don't know if you recall that, Surtsey is a volcanic island that erupted off the south shore of Iceland.
Yeah.
And we got to visit Surtsey simply because we were there at the right time.
The chief scientist.
And the chief scientist knew us, you know, and we knew him. And he took us out there. And it was, I think, one of the most exciting times of my life. We walked over lava that was less than a day old. I picked up lava that you burn your hands on the bottom part, you know, that was so. And I found the first germinating seed on Surtsey, which made me very excited. It was a grass, which probably comes by the thousands. But the first one that was ever discovered out there, I gave it to, oh dear, Thorarinsson. Sigurd Thorarinsson.
Who later became Prime Minister.
Yeah. Chief scientist.
No, He was.
Steingeber Hermansen is the one you're thinking of.
Oh, yeah.
Thorarinson was the chief scientist.
And Hermansen became prime minister.
I forgot what the hell he was doing. He was a kid. He was only 25 or something, so we sort of ignored the first time. But it was, you know, those were exciting times, really. The Iceland bit. I don't remember what started as far as Britain was concerned. I have no idea, but I got stuck on an airplane leaving Barrow without a passport or a visa or anything. Flew all the way across the top and down into Iceland.
Wow.
And then was supposed to handle public relations.
He did good.
How it worked.
Yeah, he was at a luncheon. An important luncheon. I've forgotten.
I forgot. I went to so many luncheons.
Yeah. But anyhow, they had this fish that you cure.
I remember that.
Yeah. That you cure it with barnyard droppings.
Urine, not droppings.
And it has a distinctive flavor.
I would think so.
And it's like eating smelly, warm Crisco. There's nothing to it. You know?
And so here, you know, Uncle Smarts, here he goes ahead and he wolfs it down. And
get rid of it fast.
And they said, oh, gee, you like it. And they ladled it on him.
I had to eat three helpings. Believe me, it's an acquired taste.
It's the last time you'll do that, huh?
But then I met another gal. Oh. What was her name?
Ellen Palmendaughter.
Ellen Palmendaughter. And she was the reporter for the communist papers.
No, she wasn't communist. It was the other, one of the fellows who was communist.
But anyway, I took them all out of the ice.
Yeah. I told her about the going on the ice in the good PR, but you go ahead with the story.
Well, I don't know what you were thinking of as the story, but I do remember Ellen. We were all back in the mess hall the next morning. And I don't even remember who's talking. I mean, first of all, we had 14 Icelanders, you know, and me, plus the whole station, so there was a hell of a crowd out there, a station that normally holds 12 to 14 people at the most. And then she said, Stephenson told her father that in the Arctic you always had to sleep in the nude, so she did. And I must have been 30 guys in that room said, and you didn't tell us? It was unbelievable. Yeah, I think she said Stephenson told her father. I don't know where Ellen came from, but I ended up working with Morgan Glotter.
Yeah, but tell her about the rest about Ellen coming back, landing back at Keflavik, and being greeted.
I don't remember the story of what the statement was.
Oh, the weather caused them to spend overnight.
Oh, yes. And somebody, it was one of the newspaper guys. Yeah, it was another newspaper guy that gave her a hard time. Max, I can't remember her response. Said something to Ellen about, you must have had a great time. And she said something.
And making $1,200, and she said, no, it was $1,201. It was one damn cheapskate.
Yeah, one damn cheapskate. I mean, she came right back at it. It was just beautiful the way she handled it. But then, after that trip, after I took him, prior to this, the NATO commander, which was the admiral we were working under, Admiral Weymouth, was referred to in the newspapers as the occupation master. And after that, they got 6 or 7 months where he was never called the occupation master. I mean, after that trip, we really got good press on it. It was fun, too, in a lot of ways. It was,
By the way, the Waitlist, he ended up a 3-star. And Lo, his wife, who's a French gal, we still hear from every Christmas. Mm-hmm. And do you know the Talking Heads? Have you ever heard of the Talking Heads?
The Walk Group?
Yeah.
Yes.
Lo Weymouth is a member of the Talking Heads.
Not Lo.
No, no, the daughter.
The daughter.
Tina.
Tina
Weymouth.
That's why the name sounds familiar.
Yeah, Tina Weymouth was a member of the Talking Heads. Right. So, and we met Tina when she was quite younger.
Funny.
Yeah.
No, she was just...
When my kids knew that I knew a member of the Talking Heads, did I make points.
That's what happens
to
an old man.
Money off record.
Yeah, but they're not a group anymore.
Yeah, they're not a group anymore. No, but Tina Weymouth is now a folk singer on the Boston East Coast City.
Oh, really? Huh.
At least Lo said that in her last time she was playing clubs and stuff.
So you guys, did you actually work for the Navy?
No.
Shall we say? We worked for the University of Alaska. It was all Navy money.
By the University of Alaska with Navy money.
Yeah, with Navy
money. You reported to the university.
No.
The university could not hire us without Navy permission.
It could not hire me. Excuse
yeah, that's right.
me.
I was okay.
For instance, I was appointed.
Well, the director served at the pleasure of the Navy. So, in other words, we answered to the Navy, even though
yeah.
we salary
was paid.
But you were civilians.
Civilians. Okay. And let's put it this way. Everyone else answered to the benevolence.
Even I did. Except I was afraid of you, like the rest of the world.
It grew up, shall we say, now such a system is totally impossible. In fact, shall we say, you know, the civil rights, for instance, when John Kelly, the last budget proposal that I submitted to the Navy, which, shall we say, I didn't submit to the Navy, I sent to Dr. Wood.
And he submitted. He would change the cover
letter. And I wrote the cover letter. But John typed all of them because we didn't let anyone else.
I used to type all the budget.
No, but it was a total. John had to type 8 pages. John Kelly showed me his proposal. 323 pages. And, for instance, it had come under the state system. And, for instance, I hired somebody because I thought that they had something that would contribute to the lab. I mean, there was no business how much education you'd had or anything else. It's what you would contribute. And, then the system went to, you know, how much education, were you qualified?
But, yeah, position could you... Well, you face it, I'm sure.
And mine...
It was a benevolent dictator.
It is, what did you have that would help to accomplish the job? For instance, you know, in John's case, I informed... the personnel at the university that John was on the payroll at such and such a salary. Actually, I had asked him what he would require, and I added $100 and asked him if he would accept.
Yeah.
And $100
a month. I needed $500 a month, and I started at $600.
Wow.
That was big money in the 60s.
Right? And nowadays, that's nothing.
Yeah. And I informed the Navy.
Especially since all of your room and board was provided. Mm-hmm. This was all on top of it.
Yeah.
So I informed the Navy that John was in the position. Now, the Navy had control. They could have canned me.
But but they could not stop.
But that's the only control that they had.
They could not control.
It was all or nothing.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
You really have to understand. I talked to you the other day about a contracting officer. Mm-hmm. It was a Johns Hopkins. It was a delightful person to work with, because he, you know, if you could show him that you were saving money, you were legal. He didn't care what the rules said. And we had another person like that, the scientific officer, which he just visited back in Washington, mm-hmm. Max Britton, who was unbelievably, how will I say this? When you think that Max could have totally controlled the lab, he never did. He was the fount from whom all blessings flow. He had the money, mm-hmm. everything. And yet, once or twice a year, he'd come up, and before he left, he'd say, well, I didn't think you should have done this, and I didn't think you should have done this, and you should have done this, and you should have done this. And that was all you ever heard. And then he'd go, and he'd never say another word. He was very wonderful about hands-off. Yeah, it really, we have a lot, you know, to be thankful for. And I didn't have the luxury of working under Britton. I had to work with McGregor. But he was pretty good, too, the same way. He would pick up the phone and we'd talk it all over.
But there was, towards the end of my tenure, there were some in the Navy that said that they should have a commanding officer, because by that time the laboratory had become, you know, notoriety had...
And the Navy, in their infinite wisdom, decided that the Air Force shouldn't get all the credit for running this camp. And I told you the Navy took it over.
They had given it to the Air Force for Dew Line.
And had permitted it, yeah, not given it.
They loaned it.
They're definitely...
And actually, that was the ideal situation.
Yeah.
It was just ideal.
And the
Air Force was loving it because they were spending $2 million on their camp, which was really, most of that was going to their camp, but about a third of it was going to support the lab. But they were getting such good PR, they didn't care. You know?
Yeah. This proposal went up to the Admiral. And the Admiral's remark on it was that no way were they going to appoint a commanding officer at the laboratory. Because if they did, Brewer would eat him alive. And
well, we never had a commanding officer at the laboratory.
And so they did not appoint one, which the commander or the captain that had proposed the changeover wasn't happy about. But with the Admiral's remarks, he understood the system, and I never had a Navy commander. And of course, in those days, with the system as it were, you know, I mentioned that poor John got downgraded to a commander when he went to Iceland because I didn't want to go through the foofarall when I traveled in the system. I went as a vice admiral
because of his salary. He was a vice admiral, so they put it down to a captain. You used to travel as a captain.
Well, I traveled to Iceland as captain because, you know, and I wrote the travel orders.
Mm-hmm. If you're an admiral, then they pull out all the brass to meet you.
But you guys were civilians, so how...
Oh, it doesn't matter.
Assimilated rank.
Assimilated rank. You get the same.
And, for instance, when I first went to Barrow, I had to have Navy travel orders.
Oh, really?
Assimilated rank.
So the... Native guys who worked for the lab worked for whom?
They worked for the university.
University of
the lab. So they didn't need assimilated ranks.
No, no. And our pilots also worked for the university, but since I was using them, for in Navy planes, and they were going into Navy bases and having to deal. Then they had to have a simulated rank.
You said Frankie Uckpick came off of the ice island in Iceland with you guys. He didn't need a simulated
rank.
No, no.
He came off as just regular civilian.
Yeah. And
the pilots and Max and I were all working under this stupid rank business.
Yeah, so it, in other words, for instance, Kenny Tubach sent down to cannibalize a bunch of weasels here in town. And I wrote him orders.
In those days, that's how we traveled.
Yeah, so he traveled with orders that allowed him to go on to Elmendorf and request certain services. And but that didn't carry any simulated rank. It was only when you were flying with aircraft or going on, in effect.
You had to join into the Navy system somehow.
Yeah.
Right.
That's when you had to have someone.
Well, it's probably like Public Health Service has commissioned officers and not.
Yeah.
They have to wear their uniforms once a month.
Certain, yeah, certain effects, certain things you had to do. This. And my trip, my Iceland trip was unbelievable. I cannot remember how I ended up even meeting Ralph Weymouth. That's terrible.
Well, you were there as a representative, so you...
Yeah, but I'm trying to remember the sequence.
You had to report...
I tried to report to his office the day I arrived on an airplane. And something, I don't know why, he was gone. He wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back the next morning at 8 o'clock and I had a meeting with him. And I still do not to this day know what we talked about. I think it was just one hour. But it was a good hour.
Who was this?
This was Ralph Weymouth. He was the NATO commander. Oh. Two-star admiral.
Three?
No, he was three later. He was two.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
He was vice admiral about 4 or 5 years ago. Anyway, the next morning, he asked me, or that day, he says, I have a staff meeting tomorrow morning at 8:30. I would like you to be there so I can introduce you to my staff. And I said, yes, sir, of course. What else do you say at this stage? And I really didn't know what the hell to do with myself. And his office was in a very funny, I don't know if you remember this at Keflavik, but it was in that hangar that was way out there, sort of isolated. So I had to leave the hangar and walk through practically a mile and a half across the airstrip. And
he's just exaggerating because of his old age.
You hadn't stolen the car.
No, I hadn't stolen the car yet. That's what happened the next morning at the staff meeting. We got introduced, and, oh, God, I can't say his name, but he was a friend of McGregor's. That's all I remember. There was a commander there. I was a friend of Ralph McGregor's. He was a good friend of ours, and this gets very complicated. But this guy said something about, well, we have to arrange some sort of transportation. This is a big base, you know. And I thought, oh, good, they're going to give me a vehicle with a motor pool. And I'll never forget this because it got dead silent in that room. And the admiral sort of looked around the room, and then he finally got to this Air Force colonel. He said, you're really not too far from your office, are you, Charlie? Wouldn't you like to give your car to John? And from then on, I felt terrible about the. But he was just forced into the situation. He had no choice. But he did. He was 2.5 blocks. He could walk to his.
Well, why didn't you go give him rides?
Well, I tried. And after I got to know him, which took about a week, actually, I finally did start giving him business. Call me. I don't use this damn thing all the time, you know? And so I got to be good friends with him, and I can't now remember his name. I have to go back and look at him. But that was a wild time. And then the other thing, that Iceland is very, very strongly against drinking and driving. And they love to drink in Iceland. But drink and drive, that's a no-no.
In fact, people go into the officers' club and come out and get in their cars, and they have been arrested by the Icelandic police.
Wow.
Because if you went in the officers' club, you went in for one purpose only, to drink, and you're not supposed to drive. So here I am going to all of these receptions, these parties.
Yeah, he was just a party boy.
Yeah.
I didn't know what the hell to do, so I finally went to the airport and said, I have got to have either a driver or I've got to have a way to stay in town and I come back out when I go to these things. And so I had a driver. They assigned a little seaman for my driver who would take me in and drop me at the embassy and stuff. Pick me up 4 hours later.
Then we went to Akari. Oh, the weather was miserable. And I was supposed to address the American Icelandic Club.
Yeah, that's right.
And with you know, slides and whatnot. 8 o'clock. And so we tried to start off in the morning. Akari is in the north coast of Iceland.
Really, and not that far away, 120 miles or something.
You know. And so we didn't get there until 8 o'clock at night. And that's when I'm supposed to start talking. So I'm, you know, wanting to get there. We had an 8-course meal before I went to, we went. Yeah, and the poor people had been sitting there. And so we end up getting there and I talk.
Well, they had eaten, though.
And so they said, well, they want to take us to a club because they had just gotten permission to have a club and where you can have alcohol. Big deal. And so I said, well, I was, you know, this is about, of course, it's May and light most of the night, essentially the Arctic Circle. And so I said, well, I would like to see the town and so on. So fine. You know, they're drivers. And so we go ahead. A woolen mill.
Yeah, we're to a knitting mill.
Yeah.
What time of day? This is like,
this is about 10:30.
No, no. I didn't start talking until 10. So this is about 11:30 or so. And so, yeah. So we...
They open the woolen mill and show us, and they start up some of the looms.
And and they give me a dozen pair of socks, the finest wool socks that I ever had. They shipped their export, was going to Russia. And so, this is fine.
And
we go all around town. Then we go to the club, which they'd planned to take us to earlier. And so we go to the club. This is
what's
fine.
Your remembrance of that club? All I remember is a stair, a big stair, and people everywhere in strobe lights.
Oh, strobe lights.
Music as loud as you can.
I mean, it was,
that's all I could
it remember. Was a blinding situation. And so...
We're not exactly, even in those days, we weren't exactly that young.
So, we go, and this is fine, and the club is...
They were so proud
is,
of their club.
Oh, I mean, this was something. Well, I would dearly love to go back to Akari
just to
today.
Just because my memory is so weird.
Yeah. And so we were there, but these socks, and they were just starting to send to to Saks. I think it was Saks that they were going to be shipping to. And so there was a sweater that, oh, I thought would be fine for Mary Lou. And so I asked if I could buy it. No, I couldn't buy it. And but they'd give it to me. And I insisted on paying for it. And they finally agreed, okay, I could pay for it. Cost $10. The damn things were a couple hundred in New York. But,
well, that was the other thing. Have you ever seen an Icelandic sweater?
Mm-hmm.
The ones that are made with the natural colors and the patterns?
Yeah.
All of the maids in the hotels, well, I stayed out on the base, but the maids there were Icelandic women.
I stayed there, too.
And they would
knit these sweaters and sell them to me for $5-$10. I brought sweaters back for everybody in our family. They were so cheap, it was ridiculous. And then I'd give them $5 on top of what they charged because they were just wonderful sweaters. And they're all natural and they shed water. You can wear them in the rain.
Really?
Because the lanolin of the wool is still in it. They haven't been bleached or anything.
It's sheep's wool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Icelandic sheep are a very special type of sheep. And they, you know, they brush the sheep and spin the wool and then knit the sweaters. They do the whole thing without ever bleaching out the oils. So they're really fabulous.
A year ago, you know, there's, what's this deal? Around the world in 80 days.
Oh, Hickel's thing? The northern...
No. The old day deal.
Oh, you're talking about the movie, Around the World in 80 Days.
Yeah. Well, I went around the world in 7 days.
He was on that Hickel.
Oh, you were on that Hickel flight?
Yeah.
Wow.
But it really was not Hickel. Hickel was a guest.
Well, it was the Northern Forum.
The Northern Forum.
And
Ermely.
Yeah,
and Ermely went in his place. And so we went, and that's the thing. And the other thing, there were 5 Chinese on board.
Huh.
And they were all from what in the olden days was called Manchuria.
Uh-huh.
And so coming in, there was, they had invited the people to a soiree, and but just prior to that, I told the 5 Chinese, I said, well, you know, if it's, there was, one was the vice secretary general, which, in effect, is the lieutenant governor of Manchuria. And we didn't speak English. And, but they had one fellow who spoke English among the 5. And so when he was busy, I kind of shepherded the others around. So came to hear that I had said, well, I know that you're going on to L.A. and Las Vegas and so on before going home. And if you'd like, come to the house and cook a Chinese dinner. Fine. So they, and then the invitation, you know, for a final deal. So they all came to the house. And they had a local representative and a girlfriend. So we had, in the kitchen, which is not too big, 7 Chinese out there cooking dinner, including the vice secretary general. And Chinese dumplings, the whole skinny, and youngest son, John, and you met Kelly, and the kids were here. And this was fine for the Chinese, you know. 3 generations fit in with the culture. And so they were appreciative of that. And the deal here with cooking, and this, everything went beautifully. They had 3 of their TV people, and here Mary Lou went back to the bedroom, and here the photographer is filming the bedroom.
We're on this
house, and so on. And they saw my pipes sitting there, and I had 6 or 7 pipes in this stand. And they just looked at that, and that was fantastic. Then over on the counter, I had another deal of 6-7 pipes. So
that
here,
table seldom looks any different. In fact, that's pretty quaint.
Yeah, I had 6 Chinese out in the backyard. All, you know, they pointed and laughed by them. All of them smoked, except the interpreter. And so, you know, I offered them a pipe. And in the backyard, there, six Chinese and myself, all smoking pipes in the backyard. And we had a blinking ball. Well,
Karen, before I forget, that's another Erlene.
Yeah, I recognize it.
It's a Fran. That's Nansen's, you know, the book farthest north. The Nansen bottle that they use for oceanography. Mm-hmm. Well, that's his ship, the Fran, when it reached its farthest north point.
Huh.
And these...
These look like the same woman.
That's Dorothy Livingston. In fact, that one is a... It's the next group of kids. Next to the ones that, you know, you knew the princess.
So who are the kids in this one?
I think...
I've got them in, tucked away in there.
Yeah, the names somewhere. But they're not the same kids.
No.
They're different, yeah.
But...
Hold on. Here's some.
The man in that one, you know, is that a specific person?
No, that's a Russian.
Yeah, a Russian.
It was on the cover of Soviet Life.
Mm-hmm.
And she loved it so much, she painted it.
John's taking things off your wall.
Well, I gave it to him, so.
Yeah.
So you're allowed to take it off the wall?
Those are the
are
dyes that made the rubber stamps we used on the ice stations and at the lab.
Wow.
I saved them for years, and then paint with gold and paste it in my Mustang. That should be an artist, too.
Artist three, artist
four. Must be five and six.
Five, six. Hard to read them.
Yeah, artist one up the North Pole. This is gotta be artist one.
That's, no, artist one, artist two at the North Pole.
Oh, this is T3, I remember. This was the lab itself. Uh-huh. This was the first one of the labs.
So what did you use these stamps for?
Well, you'd put them on letters, you know, and stuff.
Instead of lettering?
Yeah.
Neat.
Well, the guys would put them on the envelopes when they sent them to their friends.
You need a 40-pound. Now you need the stamped ones.
The stamped ones, yeah, I never thought of that.
So you could read them.
But I saved these for years and years and years, and for one of his birthdays, I gave them all the rubber molds. Yeah.